Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast diving deep into nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Kay, and I use pronouns like she and her.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and my pronouns are they, them, theirs.
And I'm Sarah Trone Garriott, and my pronouns are she, hers.
In this episode, we'll discuss the 21st Sunday after Pentecost, also known as Lectionary 29 or Proper 24, which this year falls on October 22nd.
Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode.
This week, we are super excited for our deep dive into civic engagement to have special guest Sarah Trone Garriott, who is an ordained Lutheran minister in the ELCA and serves as the coordinator for interfaith engagement for the Des Moines Area Religious Council. She has also represented the western portions of the Greater Des Moines metro area as an Iowa state senator since 2020. Welcome. We are excited to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So, Sarah, you are both a state senator and a pastor. Which came first?
So I was ordained in the ELCA in 2008, and I've served congregations in rural Virginia and Iowa, and now I work for a nonprofit. So I've been doing the pastor thing a lot longer, but being a minister is actually very closely connected to how I ended up in the state legislature. My state senator invited me to come pray for the opening of the day of the Senate proceedings, which is something that happens in the state of Iowa in both the House and the Senate every day. And I started paying more attention to what was happening in that Senate chamber and started getting more involved in advocacy on issues I cared about. And then eventually I ran against my state senator.
Okay. So you never know what might happen if you invite a pastor to come pray at the Senate.
Be careful who you let in.
That's fantastic. I didn't realize that that was...
Yeah, that was one of the first things I had done in my parish when I came to Iowa, was go pray at the Senate.
Wow.
That's brilliant. So what was it like then when you were deciding to run for office? Why? How? What?
Like a lot of things, it's a slippery slope. So I was, you know, the Capitol is just down the road from where I live. And so it was really easy to go down there for events, for advocacy efforts. And it was pretty accessible, I found out. And so as I was going to talk to my legislators, I was meeting other people who were pretty involved in the political process. And I met a number of women who were running for office and got involved in helping them a little bit more. And I realized that there were people like me who were running. And so that opened my eyes to the possibilities, because I had never thought of myself as a potential politician. I mean, it wasn't something I dreamed about doing ever. It wasn't something I planned to do. And so the deeper I got into things, the more I realized that, you know, I did have some of the skills it would take. And I was frustrated with my own legislators. You know, they were very nice, but they were voting for things that I felt like just really didn't serve our community well.
There's a reason we call it Iowa nice, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's more important to be Iowa kind, Iowa welcoming, Iowa helpful, and wasn't seeing that so much. And so I told my husband, you know, I'm going to learn a little bit more about running for office. I'm going to do this training program. And through that process, I was realizing, yeah, I think I do have what it takes to do it, but it was really scary to take that step forward. And I had actually met J.D. Scholten, who ran for Congress in Western Iowa a couple times.
Oh, yeah.
And he called me one day and asked me out for coffee. And I thought he wanted to talk about my nonprofit because I had told him about the food pantry network I work for. And he was like, you need to run. And that was the first time he had said to me, you should do this.
You know, I know a number of people who became pastors for very similar reasons. You need to do this now.
You know, and that's kind of what happened. And so I blame him. He knows that. But I realize, yes, I can't expect somebody else to step up and do this. Maybe I need to be the one, because it's a huge sacrifice. It's really hard. And so I finally got to the point where I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this. But then that was a hard conversation with my husband. He was like, I just know you can win. And that terrifies me. What is this life going to be like? But he was willing.
That's fair.
willing to take that step. And so I ran in 2020. It immediately became the weirdest campaign ever because of the pandemic.
Yep.
My state senator, it was about time to put our names officially on the ballot, and he announced that he was retiring. So I actually didn't get to run against him in the election. He quit. And so I ended up running against a mayor who'd been mayor longer than I'd lived in Iowa. And I wasn't door knocking because of the pandemic. That was the advice we had been given. We were all very concerned about that. And so I just barely won. I won by 164 votes. And it was a really bad year for Democrats in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And so then I ended up going into a legislative session that was so different from what I had imagined in 2019, because we had momentum. There was all this excitement. There was this optimism that we were going to flip all these seats, and that did not happen. Mm-hmm. And then I had to run again in 2022 because they changed the district lines. They cut my district in half. And my choice was, this happens every 10 years with redistricting and the census. What happened is I either had to run against a Democratic senator who had been lumped into my district in the primary, or I could move west to continue to serve the western half of my district. Meant selling my house, buying a new house, and then taking on the state Senate president. And so I did that. I sold my house and we moved. Again, it was a really hard conversation with my family, but my husband understood why I felt like I needed to do it. And my opponent, he was, you know, the second most powerful Republican in the Senate. I had served for quite a while, but I knew that he had hurt a lot of people in it with his power. And he had also said some really demeaning things about our educators, our public schools. And there were a lot of people in my district who really cared about those things. And I knew there was an opportunity there. And so I ran again and I won. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever done, moving and taking on a race like that. It was really tough. It was really ugly because my opponent could be really mean, and I won. And then I went into one of the worst legislative sessions I've ever experienced, and they've all been pretty bad. So that's saying something. Yeah. And then I get to run again in 2024 because I have to get back on the presidential cycle. So I will have run three times in 4 years when you should have a 4-year term as a senator.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't realize that you had to run again next year.
Yep. The fun doesn't stop with me.
Yeah, no.
I mean, there's something to be said for a Republican-led state legislature that is making it that difficult for you in particular to run.
You know, like, it's just how things worked out with the timing and the circumstances. But I'm glad I've had this opportunity. It's, you know, it's really hard, but it's important. Mm-hmm. And I have that opportunity. So I'm going to continue to step up and run to represent my people.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you started working for the nonprofit that you're working for before you ran. And so you've been with this nonprofit the whole time. Now, our denomination, depending on where you are, is not always the greatest about supporting pastors who are not in a congregation or a chaplaincy role, like a clearly defined pastoral role. Do you feel like you've been supported by your local synod, and have they given you any guff about not being in a traditional pastor's role all this time?
You know, I haven't encountered any resistance. I really had to go out and seek out this role and kind of create my own path for the things that I'm doing now. But my bishop has been supportive in that she says, figure it out, let me know it's working. That, you know, that will be good enough for us. So I'm glad that I can continue to have that standing because I do preach almost every weekend. It's really helpful.
Oh, that's great.
My nonprofit work. I love being out in the community in this way. I love preaching. So I'm doing a lot of pastory type things. And so it's really good to continue to be rostered. But the thing that is hard for me is that it's so hands off and it's so clear how our church body is really designed for people in the parish. And they really don't think about folks in other kinds of ministries. And so even when I'm filling out paperwork for Synod Assembly, they're like, what's your congregation? It's like, well, what do you mean? You know, is it the one I attend? Is it the work that I do?
Yeah.
They're not the same. And so I think there's just kind of a lack of awareness of that. And, you know, that's tough. And when they have conversations, when they offer programming, when they do things, it's very parish centric. And, you know, that's tough. I found being in ministry through my nonprofit and even in the state legislature to be such a great ministry experience, and I have so many opportunities that I just would never have had in the parish. And I think a lot of folks have gifts to be these kinds of public ministers. And I spend time with everybody. I don't just hang out with Lutherans. My role is interfaith, so I'm hanging out with the ecumenical partners, really anybody who will work with me, and all of these different religious groups. So I get to make friends everywhere, and it's awesome. And I would love to see more religious leaders just out in the community and present and doing that work so that they can build relationships with colleagues from different backgrounds and faiths, and then just build a stronger community beyond the walls of their church.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so jumping back to the more explicitly political side of your life, what kinds of decisions and policies do state senators deal with, and how wide-ranging is your work as a state senator?
So often when school groups come to the Capitol, I'll say, okay, what are the issues you care about? And the kids will raise their hands and say, my pets, my family, food, my house, video games, sports, water, the environment. It's everything. And our work in the state legislature really will impact all of those things, including mm-hmm. video games. It's everything, truly. Sure. And so it's very interesting because I get to learn about all kinds of things that are just not my wheelhouse. And that's why it's so important that the public is involved in the legislative process, is because legislators, we're all coming from our own kind of specific background. We're not experts on everything. Hopefully some of us are experts on something.
Yeah. But
we need to hear from the people who are most impacted and actually doing that work to understand if our legislation is going to be helpful or hurtful. And, you know, there's only so much that we can know. So that's why we've got to be bringing in the public repeatedly to hear that perspective, because there's so much that we can miss and get wrong if we don't.
And often I feel like we tend to focus primarily on what our federal tax dollars are paying for. And so what sorts of things do state taxes go towards?
So in our state budget, in Iowa, our state budget is about $8 billion. The largest chunk of that is public education. So that's a really significant piece of our work as a state, is funding our public education system. But even though it's a very large portion of the whole budget, the amount of money we're spending per student isn't really adequate to what education costs and what education needs to be the best in the country. So we're seeing some concerns with that. We fund a lot of social services, Medicaid, all kinds of, you know, services for the public, Department of Transportation and the court systems and the DNR. You know, so there's all these state employees that are doing really important work that address pretty much every area of someone's life, as well as, you know, making sure that our money is being spent appropriately and that we have accountability in government. So there are all these pieces that state money is going to. And, you know, it's, and then there's a portion that ends up going to pay for essentially tax credits as well. So when you think about our tax policy, it's really about what are we choosing to support and what are we choosing to prioritize in our state. Mm-hmm. We definitely have some needs that are not being addressed in Iowa. And our governor just recently had a press conference to talk about our surplus. We have a pretty significant budget surplus, and she's promising more tax cuts. Well, there are all these state departments and services that have been at a status quo budget for years and years and years. One example is, for 20 years, we have not increased the Medicaid reimbursement rate for dental care. So that means if you are on Medicaid, you cannot find a dentist. I mean, there's a few dentists who will take Medicaid. There's a few programs that function on Medicaid. It's very hard to find them. There's long wait lists. They're not everywhere in the state. And so that means that a lot of dental care providers, they can't afford to take Medicaid patients, because one dentist told me it would be a better financial decision for him to give that Medicaid patient $100 and tell them to go somewhere else, because serving them costs them so much.
Wow.
And the reimbursement does not cover the cost of services, the overhead, the staff time. And so what you see is, in rural communities, they can't hold on to dentists because there's so many Medicaid patients out there that they can't serve. They just can't make a go of it in those places. So they're all in the metro areas for the most part. So it hurts everybody, not just the people on Medicaid. So just an example of how when we're not keeping up with rising costs and changing world and changing needs, those services start to not really serve the public. And so we say, oh, yes, we've got all this money over here. We should just give it back to the taxpayers. Well, you know, actually, we can give it back to them in ways that are really serving them and making a bigger impact on our community.
Yeah, I think that there's been such a shift from what is the best way to accomplish these goals, and like Democrats and Republicans having two different pathways to a same goal of providing basic services, all of that stuff, to the pathways becoming the goals. Yeah. And that's what you're talking about, right? Like that it's cutting the budget is the goal instead of cutting the things that aren't needed in order. There's tricky ways of justifying, right? But I think that's such a clear example, especially like from my time in Iowa, the amount that could go to increasing public education funding, that could go towards increasing dental reimbursement stuff for Medicaid. And yet, instead, we're saying, okay, we're going to give a tax cut to either who don't need those services or who would benefit significantly from those services improving.
Yeah, so we see nursing homes closing all over the state because our Medicaid reimbursements for nursing home care, long-term care, are not sufficient to actually cover costs. So those programs are shutting down. We have a lot of older Iowans who don't have a place that they can be cared for, that they can be in their own communities often. And so that's been really hard. You know, we're thinking about, you know, where can we put our money as a state to have the best and biggest positive impact for a broader group of people? What's really going to help? I like doing what works. That's my priority, is like what will really achieve the goals we have. Yeah. And so, you know, I definitely have some different perspectives about how we should be spending that surplus money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So being a state senator, at least in Iowa, and also I'm pretty sure in most, if not all of the other states, I'll be honest, I did not go through and check all 50 of them. But being a state senator is not a full-time year-round job. So how do you and your colleagues in the Senate balance these responsibilities with the rest of your lives?
So states really vary. So in Iowa, a state legislator is paid $25,000 a year, whether you're in the House or the Senate. If you're in leadership, you get like $35,000 a year. And then we do have a per diem rate for when we're in session that adds to it a little bit. But, you know, so you see a lot of people serving in the legislature who they're business owners, so they have that flexibility, or they're independently wealthy, or they're retired. We have a large number of farmers because the session was set up to run January through April for farmers, because that's when they're not tending to their fields. And so, you know, just way out of step with what the people of Iowa, you know, are doing in their working professions. I work for a nonprofit, and it was challenging for me to negotiate with my nonprofit, even to get permission to allow them to let me run, because I might have had to quit if I had had a different position. But they were okay with that as long as we defined some boundaries. And then what I do is they've worked it out with me where I have a really flexible schedule during the session. And I'm half-time overall. So all the hours that I don't work during the session, I just shift into the rest of the year. So I'm in the season right now where I'm more DMARC Sarah than legislature Sarah. And that's the email I'm checking more often. That's the place I'm at most.
Sure.
But throughout the year, I'm doing legislative stuff, going to meetings and events. And of course, there's the whole campaigning piece, which is another part of it. And so you don't see a lot of young people in the legislature. You don't see a lot of folks with families. You don't necessarily see people in the kinds of jobs and positions that do reflect Iowa, because it's really hard to be able to serve and to figure out a way to make that work. You know, people ask me about how I achieve balance. I'm like, there is no balance ever. It's just constant chaos. One thing gets more attention than the other thing, not so much. Like, I am about 10 days behind on my legislative email, and I'm just dreading opening up that an e-box and looking to see how many 200 emails I got to go through. That's why I'm always telling my constituents, please just text me. Here's my number. Everyone can help. Because, you know, there's just so much going on all the time. But I think it is really important to have people who are in the world and the same concerns and interests as our constituents. I think that that's really important. We don't have enough folks with young families trying to make ends meet in the legislature. And I think you see that reflected in the policies that come out. We don't necessarily have the diversity of our state represented. You know, people will say, oh, I was so white. Not in my experience. There's a lot of diversity and a lot of differences that we just don't see in our governing bodies, but they are there. And it's hard for those folks to get into that system run. So that's something that is really important to me is how can I just connect people with what's happening in state government, make it accessible for them, help them find their way to start getting more involved. And I am hoping that I can also then encourage people to think about running, because that's what it happened for me is I showed up in the space and I started paying attention and then I ran. I think we can do that with some other folks who need to have their voices heard.
Yeah. And come to think of it, I'm guessing there are probably also not a lot of Christian pastors in the Senate. If the session runs from January to April, you'd have to miss all of Lent and Easter.
You know, so like I said, I preach on the weekends. Sure. So, you know, I end up doing a lot of stuff, but we have had debate, I think, on Ash Wednesday before. So there's a Presbyterian minister in the House. There's a great colleague of mine. There are some men who are ministers, but I don't think it's in the sense that they are like actually serving congregations, that they might be coming from a church body that's more they self-ordain or ordain, you know, so that they have a standing in their church body, but maybe it's not the same as the ELCA kind of sense of what a minister is. So,
sure. In thinking about how the structure currently exists and how it excludes people, is there like a different structure that you think would work better? Like, is there enough work for the state legislature to be a full-time position where then people could actually like earn enough to live on and wouldn't have to do another job? Or I don't know.
I think that there is enough work, but I'm kind of glad that we're only in session January through April because we can do a lot of damage when we're in session too. Yeah. But, you know, to be a good legislator, you can do as much as you want. And the work is just bottomless, like getting to know your community, showing up everywhere, spending time learning about all of these different topics that come up in the committees that we're working on, responding to constituent needs. I mean, that I probably spend about 20 hours a week when we're not in session doing that work. And some of it gets a little murky because I have things where I'm there as Pastor Sarah and Senator Sarah and Pastor Sarah's, you know, for DMARC. And it kind of starts overlapping sometimes. But, you know, to be a good legislator, you've got to show up and be present and be responsive. And it just takes a lot of time. So even just keeping up with the email is, you know, a few hours a week.
Yeah. Speaking of that, Pastor Sarah, Senator Sarah, when I was introducing you, I was like, normally we do Rev or like Pastor. And then I was like, Reverend Senator Sarah Trotty. I was like, I don't even know how you do it.
I believe Emily Post says that if someone is a reverend, that title always comes first and then everything else comes after.
Yeah.
I have a copy of Emily Post from 1941 somewhere.
I really appreciate when people are introducing me, when they say the titles, but they don't need to call me those things. It's important for me to be approachable and accessible to people. And so it's just fine if they call me Sarah, you know, when they're talking to me, because that is who I am. And I had a tour guide at the Capitol apologize to me last time I was there. Because she's like, oh, when I saw you a week ago, I called you Sarah and I'm so sorry. And I'm like, it is just fine. That's okay. You never have to apologize for that. But it is nice when someone's like, you know, introducing you to a group of people or something that they use your titles. That's, you know, that's just, it's just a nice thing to do.
Yeah. So in that kind of navigation, you kind of touched on this a little bit at the beginning, but what does your faith have to do with your role as state senator? I think the part of this is coming from our gospel reading today, which is the give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And there's so much, particularly in like the ways culturally we've talked about like separation of church and state and all of those things. And yet you are in fact one whole person, not two separate people. So I'm curious how, like, what does your faith have to do with that?
Yeah. So the things that I care about you know, in all the jobs that I've had, it's about the health and well-being and rights of our neighbors. And I could see in the parish and in the nonprofit world that policy directly impacts that for better and worse. And so for me, it was just kind of like another way to be called into the world to serve my community. It's just another role that I can have as a way to try to get at the things that I care about that I think are important for folks. And those are things that I see in the Gospels, you know, feeding the hungry, caring for the poor, welcoming the stranger, standing up for the weak. Those are all things that I think Jesus calls us to do. And so there's boundaries, though. People want to talk about separation of church and state. And I just don't think that it's really possible to separate your spiritual commitments from your public engagement. I think we just need to be honest about what they are and think about boundaries when we're doing that. Because I think it's good that people of faith criticize and critique and hold accountable and encourage our government to do things. I think it's a real problem, though, when religious communities use the power of the state to achieve their goals, or that one religious community gets preferential treatment over another. And so I've only done it once, but I don't quote scripture or talk about faith when I am in debate. I'm really careful about that. I really think about that because, you know, the reasoning why I want to do a lot of these things is they're the right thing to do. And there's all kinds of good evidence that backs up why it's a better way to proceed. And yes, of course, my religious commitments hold me accountable to fight for those things and work on those things. And then when I'm in a, you know, role of preaching and presiding at worship, you know, I'm not, you know, talking about policy and voting and definitely never partisan politics. Mm-hmm. But everybody knows that I'm both things. So it's just kind of always part of who I am. Sometimes I can tell a little bit better by what outfit I'm wearing or what room I'm in, what I'm supposed to be doing. But then I get so many requests to do a presentation on religion and politics and what's happening with the Food Pantry Network. And so it all kind of gets mixed up together. But, you know, my faith is really important to me. It motivates me to keep going. You know, Jesus, I think, is a huge pain, and he makes us do something to do. And that is definitely my experience with state government. It's important. It's right. Someone's got to do it. Why, Lord, does it have to be me? Okay, I guess we'll just keep going. And then whenever I preach on the weekends all the time, and so the preaching is really a helpful thing for me. It's always something that I need to be hearing. And so it's just kind of an antidote to some of the encounters and the ways that we communicate in the political world that are helpful for me.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, if I had to juggle roles like you do, I would be tempted to buy two watches, and one would be the pastor watch and the other would be the senator watch. And that way I would always know which job I was at. But I could see losing track of that so easily. Yikes.
Yeah, my calendar's a mess.
Yeah, right. Like, this is my work calendar. This is my personal calendar. This is my other work calendar.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting because you and I were colleagues when I was in Iowa. I mean, we're still colleagues, but in Iowa in particular,
yes,
we would show up at stuff together before you ran for state senate. And it's always interesting to me because as a pastor, particularly as a pastor who is very much invested in caring for people and making sure that people's basic needs are met and rights protected, in Iowa today, that is in many ways a minority opinion. And so the number of times that I would be going to the Des Moines City Council or the Iowa State Senate or committee hearings or this or that thing, and each time I went, it would be like I would bring scripture because I was there as a faith person advocating for these things. And friend of the podcast and recent guest, Susanna Porter, who used to do political organizing and field organizing, would talk about like when she would go to politicians in New Jersey and they would say, the best I can do is put this bill in a drawer because I don't have the cover to really fight it or to proactively come up with something else, because the only people that were using their faith were using it in a conservative way to restrict rights in that particular case. And so like I would just keep coming with scripture. And so I just think it's like, I get where you're coming from of, like, not using scripture in the legislative context. And I think that is part of the, like, church and state separation versus faith and politics separation, which is a different thing. And so, like,
And I'm also really cognizant that I represent 64,000 people in my district. They did not elect me to be pastor. They elected me to be senator. And there are all these different religious and non-religious commitments there. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really mindful of that. I mean, I think it's great when faith leaders show up at the Capitol and they share from their religious perspectives. And I think they need to do that because there are a lot of times that we hear a different kind of position claimed as a religious perspective. And it's not necessarily something I see in scripture or think is a priority in the Gospels. And so I think it's wonderful when people are coming from that position and doing that. But my role as a senator is different. And so, you know, if I was showing up somewhere as a minister, then I would definitely be coming from a different perspective to talk to folks. And as a, you know, as a legislator who cares deeply about people's religious freedom, you know, I'm thinking about ways that I can acknowledge and protect that too. And so we have prayer at the beginning of every Senate day, and we're no longer allowed to bring faith leaders in or anyone else in to pray. Just the senators are allowed. And so we've got a legislative body that we have one Jewish member, but it's mostly conservative white Christians coming from an evangelical kind of orientation. And so what I do is I invite people from diverse faith communities to write the prayers for me. I invite them to come and be there. I acknowledge them as the author of the prayer and I share it. So I've had the president of the Atheist Freethinkers, Muslim neighbors, leaders, Hindu neighbors, Sikh neighbors, Coptic Christians. You know, I just want to bring in that diversity of voices because if we're going to have it, then it better be for everybody. Yeah. And I also know that, you know, I would have the option of just not participating and sitting there quietly, but I would much rather confront some of my colleagues with the fact they are not an all, you know, one kind of religious perspective state. And I know that kind of gets to them sometimes, and I kind of like that.
Well, I was actually going to bring that up because I was like, because I thought you used to be able to bring people in because you were brought in, but even like it has been since you started in the Senate that they have changed that rule. Because I remember you bringing in one of your constituents who I think was Muslim and maybe.
So it changed with the pandemic. Since the pandemic, the press is not allowed in the Senate chamber and neither are anybody to come and pray. And so every prayer that I've done has been something that someone has written for me. Okay. And then they can be in the chamber, but they just can't be on the floor and actually speak. And so I think that's really too bad because it was a neat experience to be there. But, you know, I still have kind of found my way to use that time in the way that I think is effective. I know there are folks who think, you know, prayer has no place in that legislative process. And I tend to agree with that, but it's there. And I'm thinking about how to use my political capital for some other things. And so how can I use that opportunity? Just make sure that we're showing Iowa and letting Iowa speak in space.
Yeah. And that's like particularly like using something written by an atheist, I think is like this beautiful pushback and faithfulness amidst a lot of things that like you cannot actually change everything, believe it or not.
Well, and there's a lot of diversity in my community, religious diversity too. And I just love the opportunity to remind people of that. That, you know, and there's so much that I admire in my neighbors of different faiths. And sometimes people have the idea that if you believe something strongly, then if somebody's different, you have to reject that and feel threatened by that. And I come from the perspective that I can find things in my neighbors that I appreciate and am inspired by. And I can respect that it's not my tradition and it's different, but I can look at my own tradition and say, what in my tradition, what in my practice is like? Or what can I find, you know, learn about in my tradition that, you know, kind of has that same spirit. So I feel like spending time with my neighbors of different faiths actually strengthens my faith and is a really good thing.
Yeah. Barbara Brown Taylor wrote a book, I guess a few years ago now. I have no sense of time since pandemic started, but she wrote the book Holy Envy. which is that kind of an idea. And she talks about like the holy envy of learning about other religions besides your own and liking things about them and how you navigate that space without just co-opting them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I ask, when you read prayers from other religious groups, do you introduce who the prayer is from first, or do you pray the prayer first?
No, I give an introduction, and if they're there, then I point to them in the gallery and share just a tiny bit about their community, just to give a little bit of education about that.
Sure.
And I usually try to prepare those folks to be like, you know, we need some words to start our day to encourage legislators. This process can be divisive. You know, what can you offer? And kind of ask of us in this gathering to start us off in the day. So I try to help them with that and say, yeah, you know, just remember that there are people in the chamber who are not religious. There are folks in our state who are not religious. There's people coming from all these different backgrounds. So this is a public kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, the reason I ask was because I wondered if maybe praying the prayer first and then doing the introduction thing might allow some of your colleagues with different points of view to find something in the prayer that they agree with or that they like, and then realize, oh, holy crap, it came from who? But I could see how that would be a little underhanded. So,
well, and they know me, so they know it's
it's a little late for that. Maybe on day one.
Oh, Sarah's doing that thing again. So
anyway, so there has been a recent trend that I have particularly noticed among my church colleagues, but also I've seen it elsewhere, in when we talk about politics, when we talk about what we want politically, in focusing on what we stand for rather than what we stand against. And do you find this focus and this way of talking about things helpful at all?
You know, I think anything that you can do to reframe things as opportunities to come together, as possibilities, as points of connection in the political world, I think that's a good thing, because we get so much divisiveness and opposition and conflict. And I think a lot of people are just really exhausted by that. And there's a lot of folks who end up kind of tuning out because they just, that toxicity, they just don't want to deal with it. And for me, I'm always trying to find opportunities to connect with people who might be different than me. In community organizing, there's a saying, no permanent allies, no permanent adversaries. And so you could say that another way is take no one for granted and leave no one out. You know, there's always these opportunities to connect with folks, and you never know what that's going to be. And so I am hopeful. And so I'm always looking for those things. Yes, of course, you need to kind of say, this is not okay. This is a problem. But I think the public really appreciates when you can reframe it in a way that seems like, but here's what we should be doing. And here's what we could be doing. And here's how it is happening in some places. And they like to see that.
Yeah, I know I appreciate when, like, yeah, it's important to tell the truth about what other people are doing that is harmful. And if you don't tell me how to do it differently or better, then there's only so far that it can go.
Yeah.
Well, and you don't want to leave your political opponents or whoever your adversary is with no option, you know, because then of course there has to be stalemate or deadlock.
They're just going
to
dig in and be like, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I don't know, just any way that we can make things a little bit better. We need those wins.
Yeah. Speaking of people who get exhausted by politics, I've been watching a lot of Star Wars lately for the other podcast that I co-host, and recently rewatched Rogue One, which is a fascinating glimpse, particularly for Jyn Erso, in the way that she navigates getting involved in political resistance. But towards the beginning, Jyn tells Cassian Andor, I don't have the luxury of political opinions, when he's talking about the rebellion. And later she's talking about like the Imperial flags flying over every planet in the galaxy is not a problem if you don't look up. And there's this sense, especially with the first comment, that politics is so far removed or so inaccessible that I think really resonates with a lot of people. Like, we're always told vote, but voting is such a baseline. There's so much more involvement that is needed in politics. So I'm curious, like, how you respond when someone says something like that.
You know, I think that's what I see in my community is there's a lot of folks who are discouraged about the state of politics. They see the federal stuff and they just write it all off because it's just something they just don't see opportunity. Mm-hmm. They don't see good people in that world. They just think everyone's out to get something for themselves. And then there are so many people who are really struggling just to make ends meet, or they're overwhelmed by all of the stressors on their lives, you know, financial stuff, family stuff, health stuff, that they just can't, they don't have the bandwidth to keep up with what's going on. And I think that, you know, it's a complicated system. And so with state level politics, you know, a lot of people just don't understand what's happening there, how it works, how to be involved. And honestly, I think there's some elected leaders who like it better that way when people are not engaged. But there are simple ways that people can get more involved, and that my job as an elected leader is to make that process more accessible. So, you know, I am in the super minority. I'm a Democrat in a state with a Republican trifecta, but an opportunity that I have is to make state government more accessible to people. So I show up on their doorstep and introduce myself, because so many folks just don't know who their state senator is, or that they have one, or what they do. I give everyone my cell phone number because I really do want to hear from them, and I want them to know that I'm available to them. I do a lot of social media, just trying to educate people about what's happening in our legislative process in our state, and specific action steps on how they can get involved. I live tweet debates. You know, I just try to give people a glimpse of what's happening there so that they're aware, because you can't do anything if you don't know what's going on. And the public is intended to be part of this process, but it moves really fast and the communication's really poor coming out of the state house. And so people miss, it's like done before they even realize anything was going on. And, you know, so it's funny to me, I'll be out in the community and someone will come up to me that I don't know. And they'll say, "Oh, are you Sarah? Thank you for what you're doing on Twitter." And I think they're making fun of me, but they're not. They actually really mean it, because my Twitter feed becomes this informational opportunity for them to know what's happening. And, you know, I put a lot of time into my legislative newsletter. I try to respond to everyone who emails me and give them something like a next action step to do. You know, I try really, really hard. And then, like, if anybody ever wants to come to the Capitol, I'm like, "Sure, let's make a plan. I will show you around. I'll give you a tour," because I want people to know that that's their space and this is their government, and to feel rightfully that they have access to it. It takes a lot of work as a legislator to do that, though. There's so many other forces that are working against us. I am knocking doors right now just to say hi to my legislative constituents, and then also to tell them that the school board and city council elections are coming up, and here's how they can vote, because those rules are changing all the time and people don't turn out for those elections, but they have so many opportunities to be part of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. I love that you are door knocking right now for the sake of getting out the vote for the local stuff, because especially when it's not on an even year, it is just so much harder because there's just less publicity, fewer people are voting, all of that stuff. And there's actually like studies that have been done about like levels of corruption in states and whether or not they have elections on only even years or odd years as well, which is like just fascinating, because it's easier to get reelected and to just perpetuate the status quo if fewer people are voting. I'm curious, in all of this, in the senator stuff, in the door knocking stuff, in the DMARC stuff, I'm curious how the spirit has surprised you.
You know, I never thought I would be doing any of this, so that was a surprise for me.
Yeah.
And I think I'm just surprised that I've been capable of more than I ever could have imagined. Because if you had told me 4 years ago that I would have to raise $750,000 on my own and move and take on two state Senate presidents, I just, you know, I wouldn't have believed that it would be possible to do that. So, and then, you know, one of the movements of the spirit that's kind of interesting in campaign life is one of my friends who had run for an office said, "You'll be surprised how much people show up for you and how much they don't. Mm-hmm. So some of the people that you thought were going to be there for you don't. They're nowhere to be found. They're no help at all. And then there are these people that you've never met and you've had no relationship with them before, and they are giving you everything to help. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of interesting, the people that are brought into your life when you meet them and the new connections that are made. And so it really helps me when I'm feeling down to get out in the community and spend time with folks, because I get reminded of why I'm doing this and what's at stake. And then also realize that I've got a lot of resources and support out there amongst the
people. That's awesome. So you kind of answered this a little bit, but I'm going to ask it again. Okay. Anyway, and you can answer it more if you would like. How do you stay hopeful? Particularly, I'm thinking in the midst of all of the harm that so many in Iowa and other states continue to cause. So I'm thinking of the trans kids in Iowa. I'm thinking of the people who need abortions in Iowa and the ways that the Republican trifecta has really caused harm.
You know, for me, it's really good for me and my spirit to get out in the community and spend time with people, because then I'm reminded that what's happening at the government level is different than what's happening on the ground, and that the people are much more loving and caring and giving and welcoming in all of the communities in Iowa than we see from their elected representatives. It's really hard, though, and in 20 and 22, I was one of the only Democrats to win. I was the only Democrat in the Senate to flip a seat both times. And I got referred to in the press both times as the only bright spot. It is really hard to be hope for other people. It's a lot of pressure. Yeah. So, you know, I try to find ways to help myself, you know, but I don't always feel it. But, you know, when I get out in the community and see what's happening, then I can find some of those resources to dig a little bit deeper. But honestly, sometimes I have to kind of fake it and just keep going, because I know things can change. They can be different. We just have to work really hard to make that happen.
Yeah. Okay. I have one last question. You do not have to answer it. For the record, I was not thinking of this until this conversation. And then I was like, Sarah Trongary, are you going to run for governor of Iowa?
I am running in 2024 to defend my Senate seat, and that's as far ahead as I've got planned. You know, I got asked a lot this fall, mostly by the press, you know, are you going to run for Congress? And that's not work that interests me at all. And I know I've got a lot of work to do at the state level, and that's where my interest lies. And so, you know, I want to be of service. And so how am I being called to be of service in this moment? What are my opportunities? This is a question I'm constantly asking myself to get myself through the day or through the week or through the next election cycle. That's my question. And so I don't have all the answers for sure. Sometimes I think I might like to just go back into the parish and do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just have learned that I got to be open to the possibilities of what I'm being called to do. The great thing is that I know I'm not the only one in Iowa who needs to be doing this work. So it doesn't just have to be me. I'm just going to put that out there into the universe too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just had to ask, because I was like, there are things that you are saying and ways of talking about rural communities, which is not your constituency necessarily, or not the primary amount of your constituency. And yet, like, that stuff that I didn't know that about dental Medicaid. And I didn't know, like, I had some guesses because of my work as a hospital chaplain about, like, how that impacts rural communities. But to, like, get
You know, when we make laws at the Capitol, when we make decisions, it impacts the entire state. And something that I'm always trying to help my colleagues here, especially in the majority, is that just because you have a district that's a certain way doesn't mean that this is going to impact other folks in the same way. And I want them to realize that I've got a district that's almost kind of a microcosm of the state, where I've got a fastest growing suburban community in the entire state, fifth fastest growing county in the nation. And then I've got these rural pockets on the edges too, these small towns and farmland and whatnot. So, you know, we need to be trying to think of things, not just from our perspective, but having a big picture. Yeah, it's complicated, but I really appreciate when I get the opportunity to go out to all these different communities and see what's going on for them. I was a pastor in a really rural community, and so I'm tuned into some of those concerns from that time, living in a community that was literally just a crossroads. It wasn't a town. Mm-hmm. And then I've lived in Dallas County, West Des Moines, which is, you know, I can see like 15 houses out the back windows of my house right now because it's the suburbs. And I've lived in Chicago on the south side and in Philadelphia and Boston. So I've had a lot of different kinds of experiences. And, you know, we need to keep all of those pieces in mind when we're drafting legislation for the state, because we need to do well by everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you curious about how the Twilight Saga is influenced by Mormon theology?
Or why so many vampires are queer-coded?
Have you sat up at night pondering if the documentary Jesus Camp counts as a horror film?
Or have you ever wondered which slasher icon is which member of the Trinity?
Do you ever get into debates about whether the movies Casper, Ghost, and Candyman can be part of the Ghostbusters expanded universe?
Have you watched most of the Nightmare on Elm Street series before the age of 10?
What? Who does that?
Okay, maybe that one's just me. But if you answered yes to any of the other questions, then we've got the podcast for you.
And if you answered yes to Pace's question.
That too. I'm Pace, and I am the super nerdy horror person who's been a horror fan since well before the age when it was appropriate to watch these movies.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the inevitable queer coding somewhere in every horror movie. And we are the hosts of Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast hosted by two non-binary trans nerds.
Each season, we follow a horror franchise and a host of other horror and horror-adjacent movies to talk about how they connect to queerness, religion, and theology.
We feature bona fide scary movies like Halloween, The Witch, Candyman, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and Suspiria.
We also have non-scary movies or low-stake horror movies like Ghostbusters, The Addams Family, Doctor Strange, and Hocus Pocus.
Our upcoming season, we are covering A Galaxy Far, Far Away by looking at the Star Wars and Alien franchises from queer, religious, and horror points of view.
So whether you're a lifelong horror master like me,
or a horror padawan like me,
we have a place for you at Horror Nerds at Church.
Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you catch your podcasts.
As we dive into the readings, our first reading today is from Isaiah chapter 45, verses 1 through 7. God speaks through Isaiah to tell the people that Cyrus has been chosen to rescue them from exile.
So one of the themes in this is the ways that God uses the unexpected for liberation. So in this case, Cyrus is the leader of another nation, and yet that is who God is naming as a chosen one to liberate the people. And I couldn't help but think, I think it was Montana. It might have been Wyoming. I might be wrong on this one. But during Obama's term as presidency under Obamacare, the state legislature, which was heavily, heavily Republican, passed a law that said healthcare decisions shall be made by the individual or something like that. Like, a person is able to make their own healthcare decisions. The government shall not interfere with a person's healthcare decisions. Fast forward to the last year or so, and the legislature tried to ban abortion, and it went through their courts, and their own state Supreme Court said, no, you have a law that says the government shall not interfere with a person's health care. And so it was their own thing that they did out of like spite and all sorts of things that then became a liberating force for people who could get pregnant or need abortions in that state. And I was just like, brilliant Republican.
Yeah.
The fun ways God works.
And, you know, having grown up being raised by a Republican myself, being against the government getting involved in people's healthcare decisions is actually a, you know, genuinely Republican standpoint. So, like, they're being themselves. Good for them. And then in verse 2, we read, I will go before you and level the mountains. I will break in pieces the doors of bronze and cut through the bars of iron. And I have to say, at this point, God is basically casting himself as a combination of Quake from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., what with the leveling of the mountains, and Magneto from X-Men, what with all of the breaking up of the various metals. And that would be amazing and a very powerful friend to have. And also, I don't know if it would be a movie or a TV show, but I want to watch it. So I'm just saying.
That would be a delightful crossover for sure.
Yes. Like, I'm kind of wondering at this point, we have so many different superhero stories. When Jesus comes back, is it going to be as a superhero just to, like, get into that zeitgeist?
And I really appreciate in all of the scriptures how it's those unexpected people that end up being called to do things that are working towards God's purposes. And, you know, I take a lot of comfort in that, and I try to remind folks of that, because I think everyone else thinks, no, I'm not the one. I'm not the one who should be doing this. I'm not the one who can do this. Someone else should. And, you know, in my own political experience, no, everybody has the ability to act and make a difference in the world, to be that one. And so, you know, I'm always encouraging folks to think about the possibility that the person we need could be them. And that's, I did that today. I was in a meeting and I was like, you know, maybe you need to run for office. Yeah. And I think we have this opportunity to remind each other that we can be the person to do the things that need to be done. And that gives a lot of good sense of power and agency.
Yeah. I loved in congregations when someone would come and say, I think someone needs to blah, blah, blah. And I would be like, okay, how can I support you in doing that? Right? Because, like, my role as pastor is to support the ministries of the congregation. And if somebody thinks that needs to be done, well, then I will support them as they do that.
Yeah.
I was also looking at the beginning of verse 3, where God says, I will give you the treasures of darkness and riches hidden in secret places, so that you may know that it is I, the everlasting, the God of Israel, who call you by your name. And I'm always reminded of the book God's Holy Darkness by a friend of the podcast, Nick Peñaranda, who is on last season. And also, our house has been growing a lot of different things. And so just thinking about growing things, and that the darker the soil, the better and the richer it is for plants to grow. And so that, like, the treasures of darkness and the riches hidden in the secret places of soil. I love that.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I don't think we get that enough.
No.
And then our second reading is 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 1 through 10. Paul begins his letter to the church in Thessalonica with praise for their faith and conviction. And as I was thinking about this, this is the beginning of the letter, but Paul is talking about the ways that his relationship with the people of Thessalonica has changed him, and the way that it has changed them, and the ways that relationships in general change us. And my favorite example of this comes from the Ember in the Ashes series by Saba Tahir, which our listeners know that I absolutely adore. And Laya develops, unknowingly at first, this relationship with the Nightbringer, who is like the big bad. And in developing that relationship, and she gets a different perspective on the Nightbringer. And so even though there is a pull towards dividing it into good and evil, and that, like, very clearly false binary, she gains this nuance and complexity, and the story itself gets to be a story of complexity of humanity and of people and creatures and mythical beings and all of that, that is a rarity, I think, in a lot of fantasy that I read. So I really like that one.
And apparently I'm reading verse 2 again. In verse 2, we read, we always give thanks to God for all of you and mention you in our prayers constantly. And listen, Paul, it's not that I don't believe you, but you literally say this front and center at the top of all of your letters, like all of them, all of the ones we have anyway. And it's to the point where all of the people who are pretending to be you writing letters also put this at the top of all their letters. And I think that it might be that you pray for all of your fellow Christians, and especially those starting new churches in general. constantly every day. And that's great, but it's not exactly the same thing as praying for these particular people by name, you know? And I kind of wonder if President Bartlet in West Wing had something similar going on with the number of people that he was supposedly paying a lot of very particular attention to. Like, really, he had people for that. And it's not that he didn't care, it's that he had a lot of stuff going on. And so the people he had would pay attention to the particular people. And he was generally trying to keep an eye on the whole concept, the whole ongoing process of all of the different things. And I kind of wonder if maybe that's what Paul is doing. Which is not necessarily a bad thing, but also, like, not exactly how he's phrasing it. You might even say it's political or diplomatic of him to say it this way.
So I have a little bit different experience of this because I have been traveling to all these county Democratic parties to go talk to them. Yeah. And I feel a little bit like Paul in these moments. And what's happening internally is I am needing to see hope. And I get discouraged and I get frustrated and I need to see things that encourage me. And for me, appreciating getting out into the community and seeing what people are up to and appreciating that is helpful. So in part, maybe Paul is telling himself, reminding himself these things with these very effusive words as a way to encourage himself about his ministry matters. He's doing a good job. These things are happening and it's good because I can imagine it's getting pretty, you know, hard to do that and keep going. But then also for those folks out there, I mean, they don't know about the other letters to the other folks. They think they're the only ones possibly, but they're needing encouragement too. And they need to know that somebody cares about them and loves them and sees possibility in them. And that, you know, then makes it be.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that. Yeah. I was looking at verse 6 and the line, "And you became imitators of us and of the Lord, for in spite of persecution, you received the word with joy, inspired by the Holy Spirit." And I grew up with the phrase, "Imitation is the highest form of flattery." And I mean, yes-ish, unless it's AI, which is not actually intelligent, just artificial, and it's just stealing intellectual and other property from people, especially artists, in which case that does not seem flattery. That seems like theft.
Yeah,
it's a whole different
thing. It's like, can you imitate in a way that's authentic to you, that, you know, it's like a tribute.
Yeah,
which makes me think of that Tenacious D song. Do you know which one I'm talking about? My kids have gotten way into early aughts and 90s music, and so I get to hear
retro
tribute on the way to school, like multiple times a week. So it's not the greatest song in the world. It's just a tribute. But, you know, I think about, like, in my interfaith work, I really admire the Sikh community. I love some of the so many things about them. But when they wear the turban, it's to stand out in the crowd. And that's going back to some of their history where people were being persecuted and they just, like, no one stood up to help them. And they wanted, you know, a way for folks to stand out so they could not pretend they were not Sikh, that they were part of this community. And their job was to stand up for the vulnerable and protect people and help. Yeah. And so I love that they wear the turban specifically to stand out in a crowd, to look different so everyone knows who they are at every moment, and that there are people who are there to help. I'm not going to start wearing a turban as a Christian, but I'm like, how can I, in my own way, authentic way, think about how can I stand out in the crowd as a person who wants to be there for others to help,
yeah,
so that they know who I am. And so, like, you could take the idea and try to live it out in your own way. And then it's not that necessarily trying to imitate or copy or rip off.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and even the how do I hold myself accountable to helping when I am somewhere, whether I stand out or not, right? Because that's what the standout is for. And so, yeah, I like that, the different ways that we can imitate respectfully.
So it's not cultural appropriation.
Yeah, which, like, this is the perfect time for that particular conversation because we're about to hit Halloween and cultures are not costumes, folks. No. Cultures are not costumes.
Yeah. And our gospel reading is Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 through 22. Jesus foils an attempt to trick him into saying something treasonous when questioned about taxation.
I love this because it is a queering of the binary where Jesus is given pay taxes, don't pay taxes. And he's like, False binary. There's more at work in this. And it's interesting also because we use this passage to say, you have to respect the government and do whatever the government says, which is not what Jesus is saying. But there is this like pushing and blurring and queering that line of like, no, it is not this clear, like we pay taxes or we don't pay taxes. We are called to this thing. And how do we do this thing is a whole different conversation. But it also reminded me of the movie Elemental, which just came out on Disney Plus, came out, I think, this summer. And it is like a kids animated romance-ish thing between like every... All of the characters are different elements. So there's fire characters and water characters and earth characters and wind characters. And so there's a romance that happens between fire and water. And it's just this fascinating, like, nobody thinks it's possible. And they, like, start to figure out, like, what does it look like? Is it possible? What does it look like to care about somebody where you're not supposed to at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also great on like first generation, second generation immigration stuff.
Ooh.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I haven't watched it yet because I thought it was just a ripoff of, oh gosh, the movie about the emotions.
Oh, Inside Out. Oh, yeah, no, not at all. It's good. I liked it. Cool. I liked it when I saw it. So.
And Emily, I know that you love the phrase false binary, and I would never want to take that away from you, but I also want to point out that sometimes when you say false binary, the other thing that pops into my head is there is a tiny little clip from an episode of Friends from a million years ago of, I think it's Monica and Phoebe are trying to help Chandler think through some relationship stuff, and so they're giving him a pop quiz on how to handle relationships, and they always give him a couple of options, like all of these are multiple choice questions, and then usually the correct answer is, actually, it's secret option C.
Yeah.
And so the actually, it's secret option C always pops into my head whenever we have these conversations, which
it's
is
true.
A,
it's true. Frequently that is the case.
I love that because it's a really disingenuous question. You know, they're trying to trap, they're trying to trick. And yes. I encounter a lot of questions like this in the political world because the goal is just to embarrass or catch your opponent. It's not to actually discern the right answer or the best way. It's just to like get the other person. And Jesus turns that around and says, actually, it's the secret option C, where, you know, this is a complicated question that we should be grappling with. And here are some ways to think about that, that you're left wondering and struggling with it instead. He turns it into an actually really genuine moment and concern.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as we jump into the verses, in verse 17, we read, "Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not?" And we don't actually get to preach on this text too often. It doesn't show up very much in the lectionary. And so this is my chance to remind you, our listeners, that the IRS actually has, hands down, the best customer service folks I have ever worked with or indeed heard of. Like, these folks, if you can get through to them because they are often underfunded, are magical. They are a delight. They may have magic powers. That was unclear. I have called these folks literally crying twice, and both times they have fixed all of my problems. And that is remarkable. And they also, like, very carefully got me to stop crying before they fixed my problems so that I could actually hear what was going on.
That's amazing.
And so, yeah, my understanding is that basically, as long as you aren't screaming at them from the get-go, they are delightful and wonderful people. But a lot of times people are screaming at them from the get-go, and that's, you know, not fun for them. So if you ever need to call the IRS to get something straightened out, you may have some trouble getting them on the phone in the first place, but once you do, they are wonderful. And also the tax collectors in Jesus' time, that is a whole separate universe of twisted issues and betrayal and so forth. And today is not necessarily the day to talk about that. But
yeah, you can't.
It's true.
Yeah, you can't just take that context and apply it to today's because, you know, they're in occupied territory. They've been conquered by this foreign power. And that the taxes that they're paying, it's really extortion. I mean, it's not going, you know, it's not like a covenant, a contract where they're getting services in response. They're getting dominated and crushed in response. They're paying for brutality. And we would hope, you know, it's not a representative government in those days. It's, you know, the warlord that won. You know, we would hope that in our own country, it's more about, you know, a relationship a contract between the people and their representatives negotiating what we're going to do together. Ideally, that's what government is. It's how we solve big problems. I know that's not always the case. You brought up Blagojevich. You know, it's like, yes, there is corruption. Yes, there is waste and misuse. There are things that our money is spent on that we don't like. But, you know, it's just a very different context than what we're living with today.
Yeah.
I was looking at verse 21, and the folks who came to test Jesus answered the question of whose head is on the coin as the emperor's. And then Jesus said to them, give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God. And it raises questions of belonging and property even. And it made me think of two kind of disparate things, right? One is the advice I was given on internship and the bottle of red nail polish to go along with it to write pastor in red nail polish on anything that was, so like on a baking dish or something like that was mine, and I would always get it back. And I was like, that's fascinating, because otherwise like it gets jumbled into the whole thing, but nobody's going to take the thing that says bright red pastor. And I was like, okay. And so that stuck with me. But also the thing that frequently is preached on in this passage is, but really it's all God's anyway, right? If we're talking about belonging, yeah, it has the emperor's head on it. But ultimately, the emperor is part of this whole image of God that we all share a little fraction of. And, you know, the little comic of Jesus looking in the mirror, and it's like all of these different people looking back. And that's the thing, is like, what is our ultimate goal? Our ultimate allegiance, our ultimate loyalty, our ultimate belonging even is to God and not to the emperor.
Well, in Rome, the emperor is viewed as the god. So it's interesting that bringing that coin into the temple, they're bringing a graven image. They're bringing an idol into that space, which is a real violation of their own religious practice. That's why the money lenders are there, so that they can switch out their money and use an appropriate kind of currency to fulfill their temple responsibilities. You know, so Jesus is kind of, maybe you could say he kind of tricked them to show themselves to be hypocrites with all this faithfulness stuff. But, you know, God in the scriptures, in the gospels, especially, pretty clear about how God wants us to use our time, our money, our power. And it's a very different kind of approach than this kind of brutal power and selfishness that the ways of the world tend to push. So I got to say, I had one thing when I was in the parish that had my name on it, and that was my extension cord with the power strip. I had like a 24-foot long extension cord, because there was never an extension cord I could find anywhere, and it was the most precious thing to me, and it still says Pastor Sarah on it. And if the Lord ever has need of it, I'm glad to let it be used, but I want my extension cord back.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
That is real.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And now for our most engaging segment. Musical. This is the time where we cast any of the Bible passages we talk about as Muppets musicals, whether we're casting a token human or a Muppet as a character or anything between or beyond. So, Sarah, do you have a Muppet or a token human that you would cast for any of the readings for today?
Maybe Animal as Cyrus.
Okay.
He doesn't seem like a particularly useful guy, but I think he can surprise us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Kay?
I was thinking about who would like be taking the money and organizing it and counting it and all of that. And of course, if you're going to count something, I think we need Elmo from Sesame Street.
What?
And
George Won't Count.
Well, yes. Well, see, Count Von Count would be the one counting it, and then Elmo would be the one carefully putting it into stacks and making sure that everything was, you know, separately in its own little groups and just wind up surrounded by stacks of coins and would be absolutely delighted in that, I think. So yeah.
I do think that Elmo and Count Von Count counting things together,
that would be very fun.
Be hilarious.
Also, I wonder if Elmo would wind up with a tiny little costume for Elmo's self, maybe a little cape, while working with Count Von Count.
That sounds about right to me.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I do really like Animal as Cyrus.
Yes.
I was like, where are you going with Animal? And then when you said Cyrus, I was like, very unexpected. Mm-hmm. Which is Cyrus in this? Yeah.
Also, there's a certain amount of, you know, ruckus that happens in what Cyrus does. And yeah, Animal can do that. Mm-hmm. How about you, Emily?
I'm a fan of Count Von Count as the one counting the things and counting the money for all of the things. Yeah.
Ooh.
But if we're including Elmo, I would include Elmo in the Isaiah passage for the treasures of rich darkness. Because there's a picture of Elmo in, like, gardening mode that I saw. Because I see lots of Muppets on Twitter these days. And it was
adorable. That is the best possible use of Twitter. Absolutely.
It's true. Second best. I think Sarah's use of Twitter is pretty spectacular. Yes. But yeah, gardening Elmo, I think, is where I would go for Isaiah.
Sure. But I would expect that Elmo would be wearing gardening gloves, because otherwise, like, getting dirt out of that red fur would be an awful lot of work.
Elmo was in the picture, I think. So.
Sure. So, Sarah, any other thoughts on life, the universe, and everything?
You know, I know that a lot of folks get frustrated, they get discouraged about whatever. There's so many things that people can get discouraged about. And I feel like for me, what always helps is just to go do something and do anything. Action, being with people, just doing anything, even if it's not really related to the problem. I always feel like the answers kind of come out. So, you know, that's what's kind of kept me going when things get tough, is I'll just go out and start working on something. And then I see new possibilities and new opportunities. And then that's mm-hmm. really helpful. And just really appreciate how you all are trying to create some community for folks in a different way online around these topics. Because there are people looking for meaning and for community and maybe not finding it in the usual places. So thanks for doing it.
We like doing it.
Absolutely.
And thank you for your work and for your service.
Absolutely. And for joining us.
Yeah. And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us as well. Our theme music was by Rachel Meyer Lachlan, and Muppets music was by Brenda Boss. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 22nd Sunday after Pentecost. This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing and Kay Roloff. For more fun, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and now Blue Sky at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com. And we're a little bit sending our audiograms to TikTok, so if you've caught them, catch you there.
Great. Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. It's cheaper than paying your taxes, certainly. That's not a very impressive thing to compare it to, sorry. It's cheaper than paying for the public education in the state of Iowa by a significant amount. Yeah.
Also, let us know on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christians said, Hoc Sluviscum.